Accession number 32297, reel 22.
John Dixon, reel 22.
Okay, so there we are. We're talking about Raytog. I mean, the other thing, of course, obviously, you could lose one or the other. And I mean, the fifth alternative, of course, was if neither rocket's fired. Now, this did sometimes happen. Bearing in mind that you're in hot, damp, muggy, humid sort of climate, and the electrical connections that you need to fire the rockets. Well, we all know that electrics and water don't always go together very well. So it was quite possible that neither of the rockets would fire, in which case you really were in trouble because you probably ran out of deck and you got airborne, or you nearly got airborne, and you were likely to fall into the sea just ahead of the ship, which was coming at a rate of knots behind you. I never saw it happen. I don't know. These are just stories that pilots tell that what could happen if the rockets didn't fire.
And are there any other things about flying in the tropics that are different from flying in a temperate climate?
I think the worst thing was actually climbing in and out of the aeroplane because it's standing out in the sun, especially in a place like Catacaranda. And you could burn the skin off your hand if you put your hand on the trying to climb in and out without putting some gloves on. So I don't think there was anything else except to say you've got to watch the weather because you get these tropical storms can come up very quickly. But we didn't, while we were in Ceylon, apart from playing silly devils with Raytog, we didn't do much flying. I mean, we were worked up. I mean, what was there to do? We'd practiced everything. There was a sad thing that happened there. I've explained that we started off as 12 aircraft, we increased to 16, we ended up with an 18 aircraft squadron. We get to Ceylon and they then decide that we don't need a big squadron anymore. We can reduce down, and I think we reduced down to 12 aircraft again. So there were a lot of superfluous sort of people floating about. I thank goodness that I didn't. I stayed with the squadron from beginning to end. But Bambi, my observer, and certainly two or three other observers were given the option of opting out. And they, I think they had put themselves down to be retrained as pilots. It was never really a serious option, I think, at that time of the war. But they were taken off the squadron, and so I said goodbye to Bambi, my observer, and he hung around in Ceylon for a few weeks and eventually came home.
What had happened with yourselves, obviously, when you were there for a month or so, weren't you?
Yeah.
How did you leave Ceylon, and where did you head to there?
While we were there, there were, again, these are just rumours, Richard, that float around. We were then, of course, operating, we weren't operating, we were based in Ceylon, which was part of the East Indies fleet, and it was all part tied up with the Burma campaign and General Slim and the 14th Army and all this. And there were quite a few of our escort carriers were based in Ceylon at the time, mainly operating Hellcats, Corsairs and that sort of thing. Oh, and Avengers. They had some Avengers out there. And the rumour was then that we three carriers, Vengeance, Venerable, Colossus, were going to form part of the Dutch East Indies, not the East Indies fleet. And, of course, the big boss in that area was Mountbatten. I don't know who the Admiral was, but nobody quite seemed to know whether we were going to stay there or not. One rumour was that they'd had barracudas out there before, and the performance was pretty diabolical, so nobody wanted us. So once again, they thought, well, maybe we'd switch us on to Avengers and we'd fly from the shore base or something, whatever. But in the end, no, we stuck together as a carrier group, and we moved on out to the Pacific, to Australia, where we joined the British Pacific Fleet. Now, again, it's getting a little bit political, all this, but the war in the Pacific, of course, was predominantly, hugely run by the Americans. It was an American war. And they had developed incredible resources, and, you know, their production, they'd got carriers dropping out of their ears. They were able to operate 17 big aircraft carriers all at one time. They didn't actually do it all in one fleet, but I mean, they had huge reserves. And the big boss, well, there were two big bosses in the Pacific. There was General MacArthur, who was very much a prima donna, as I think we've all heard. But he was, of course, in charge of the land campaign, basically. And there was Admiral Ernest J. King, who was the American admiral. And these two gentlemen fought like cat and dog. And Roosevelt had to try and keep the peace between them. I don't know whether he ever succeeded. But anyway, the point was that around about November 1944, when it was obvious that the war in Europe was going very well, and that there was a victory could be seen, Churchill had gone to Roosevelt and had said to him, look, we will come and bring our fleet out to support you in the Pacific. There was a slight ulterior motive to this, because of course we'd got all our possessions, or what had been our possession. I mean, the obvious was Singapore and Hong Kong, and we wanted them back. There was a threat, of course, that the Americans, being so strong, might have sort of pushed us on one side. Anyway, Churchill had said to Roosevelt, well, look, you can have our fleet and they'll come out and join you as and when you want them. Roosevelt dithered. Ernest J. King didn't want us at all. He was very anti the British fleet, partly because we didn't have the backup that his fleet had. The story is that Churchill actually had to bang his fist on the table and say, do you want us or not? And Roosevelt intervened and said, yes, of course, we'll have you out here. Ernest King had to accept that we would join them. Okay, to be very gracious about it, he was grateful eventually that we did go out and join them, but he didn't welcome us. Anyway, this was all a bit political. We didn't know any of this, naturally. It didn't come out until years after the war, because we thought we were all buddy-buddies. But that's what happened to us. We left Ceylon. We did a couple of dummy attacks just for fun on the Cocos Islands, which is sort of halfway between Ceylon and Australia. You've probably heard all this before, but we did dummy attacks, the chaps with the Corsairs, they flew round and round at low level, beating the place up. They were developing their skills as photo reconnaissance pilots, and they'd got these big cameras on, installed in the Corsairs, and they got very good results. We laughed because there were all these native girls who wore nothing but grass skirts, and we reckoned that's what they were trying to get the pictures of. it all sounds a bit childish now, but it was I think there was something in it, you know. Anyway, this was on the way out to to Australia. It's just one other rather interesting thing. The last of our big fleet carriers, the sixth in the line was, victorious, or last of all, the last one was Implacable, HMS Implacable. And she wasn't really commissioned until 1944, I think. I noticed in my logbook the other day something I'd completely forgotten. While we were up at in Scotland, long before we left the UK, we had actually done a dummy attack on Implacable, pretending to torpedo her, I suppose. When we were in Malta, she'd left England after we had, complete with her air group. She had Fireflies, Corsairs, goodness knows what. And she'd sailed after us, but she came straight through the Mediterranean while we were stuck in Malta. And so they sent us all off, not just our lot, but all the other squadron. We did an enormous attack on Implacable as she went through the Mediterranean. She couldn't fly because her decks were loaded with aircraft. She couldn't fly off any defensive aeroplanes to stop us, but we had a great fun. But she left the UK long after us. She went straight out and she was operating in the Pacific before the war's end. We never got that far.
Where did you get to in Australia? Where's the places?
Well, we originally anchored off Fremantle, which is right somewhere near Perth, isn't it? Western Australia. We didn't go ashore, but we were all anxious to see Australia. We thought it was pretty dreadful. It was, as far as I can remember, it was just like a lot of tin shacks with corrugated things. It was. I thought, well, wouldn't want to go ashore here, you know. It really, it was a bit grotty, but it was just a naval base. Anyway, we didn't stay there, and we just anchored for a little while, reprovisioned, I suppose, and then off we went. We sailed round through the Australian Bight, and it was absolutely gorgeous. Early one morning, we were ready to fly off. And although we were probably 20, 30 miles out at sea, you could smell the wonderful the gum trees and the eucalyptus trees, which are sort of all really part of the Australian scene. And you could actually smell them while we were out at sea. And it was just a wonderful sort of scent. And it lifted our spirits because we thought, well, you know, anything to get off with this stifling old ship for a bit. Let's get ashore. So off we flew, and we landed at a place called Jervis Bay, or as the Australians say, Jervis Bay. And this was about 70 miles south of Sydney. It was originally an RAAF airfield, but the Navy had taken it over as what we call a MONAB. I'll come to that later on. But this is where we landed early one morning. It was absolutely gorgeous. The climate was perfect and it was absolutely superb. We were thrilled to bits to be there. And we were then carted off to a hotel which was almost on the edge of the airfield. It was called the Lynx Hotel. I always remember the Lynx Hotel. And we were said, right, lads, breakfast. So we went into this, what presumably was the dining room, I don't know. And there were these very, very pretty Australian girls. And the breakfast, you've never seen anything like it. And there were eggs, there were bacon, there were cutlets, there were chops. And there was a wonderful thing called lamb's fry. We didn't know what lamb's fry was, but these were kidneys. So, I mean, it was absolutely wonderful when we just feasted on this. And what was even better, they then said, well, there's no accommodation on the airfield itself, because it was just a landing strip, really. So you'll all be living here in this hotel, in the Lynx Hotel. So that's where we were actually billeted for the length of time we were there, and it was like real luxury. We'd never known anything like this before. Even things like butter, gorgeous butter, and I mean, it was hugely impressive. So we were very, very happy. And there was you may have heard this from somebody else that you were talking to. While we were at the Lynx Hotel, in the hallway as you went into the hotel, there was a fruit machine. I'd never seen fruit machines before. I hadn't trained in America, so I didn't know anything about fruit machines. But the lads who, particularly the Corsair pilots, who were all American, they knew all about fruit machines. So we put our money in and lost it. and one of the Corsair pilots had got a system. And he'd worked out, I don't know whether you've heard this before, that you played the machine until you got a winning combination and the money came out. So you took your money. You then, three or four of you probably, tipped the whole machine on its side through 45 degrees. You had to hold it there through 45, and you held it there. You put another coin in and you gently pulled the handle so that it clicked, but the disc didn't spin, so it paid out again. And you kept doing this, but obviously in the daytime you couldn't sort of do this because there were too many people about. So there were about six of us formed a syndicate, and the idea was that we got up in the middle of the night and we came and emptied this machine, which is what we did. I don't suppose there was more than £3 or £4 each that we shared out, but by golly, you know, it was big money. And we'd worked this out. And then the next day we came down and we looked at it and we thought, oh, we could do that again when it gets a bit more money in it. But they chained it to the wall. So that was the end of that. Anyway, there's a bit of an issue for you. Well, there we were. So we were back at Jervis Bay or Jarvis Bay. So the other squadrons from the various ships went to different airfields around Sydney. Places got Schofield, Nowra. And there was a big airfield just outside Sydney. You could almost see Sydney from, called Bankstown, and that was the holding base where all the new aircraft went. I'll come to that in just a sec. But what I almost forgot to tell you was that the morning we arrived at Jervis Bay, we flew ashore at the crack of dawn, had breakfast. And then Cedric, the CEO, came and he said to Johnny Cookson, Dickie Burns, or Robbie as we called him, and me, you three, he said, you've got to go back on board because we'd left three barracudas behind when we flew off in the morning. I don't know whether it was because they had something wrong with them or what, but they needed, the captain didn't want them on the ship. We had to get them off. So we thought, okay, well, we don't mind. So they had a boat, and off we went to the ship. The ship by then was anchored in the little bay just off Jervis Bay. It was, you could see it. So we went off by boat, and we climbed on board, and we fondly believed that the captain would pick up the anchor and would sail out to sea to give us a good bit of wind speed over the deck to get us airborne. But the commander flying, who was of course still on board, he said, well, what are you hanging about for? You've got to get on with it. So we said, well, we can't, the ship's still at anchor. Oh, he said, you're going to fly off with the ship at anchor. So we thought, how can you do this? He said, well, you're going off the accelerator, off the accelerator. And we said, well, that won't give us enough airspeed to get airborne properly. And we said, oh, yes, it will. He said, we're going to crank the accelerator up to the full pitch. In other words, when they fired off the Corsairs, they had to go off with a bigger charge than with us because they needed more airspace. So we said we'll put the full maximum on, and you'll go off while we're at harbour. You see, and we didn't much like the idea, but of course we now know that it can be done. Anyway, the three of us looked at one another, and we thought, well, we'll draw lots for this. So we had a drew straws or whatever we did, and I was quite happy because I drew number two, and Johnny Cookson was number one, and I was two. Dickie Burns was number three, and I thought, well, if Cookie goes off and it doesn't work, I certainly am not going. You see. Anyway, so we all get into our aircraft and we start them up. And so what happened? Johnny Cookson, he's an artful monkey, he's an old Harrovian, I should add, decided that his aircraft was a US anyway. So he put the thumbs down and switched off and called the fitters over, and I should just say my aircraft is not fit to fly, which it probably was, but anyway. So Dixon is next up, so I go off. And I can honestly say that I really was blacked out because bang, I went off. I did remember to leave the brakes off this time. So off I went, and the time I'd opened my eyes, and then it was like that. It was really woof. There was the airstrip right in front of me. I mean, because we were that close. So I didn't even bother to pick the undercarriage up. I just put down some landing flat, and landed. So I virtually was shot off the ship onto the airfield. And I shouldn't think I was in the air couldn't have been more than a minute. But my logbook, of course, records 5 minutes. You couldn't really record less than 5 minutes. And I made a note in my diary that it must have been the shortest flight since the Wright brothers. Anyway, it's a silly story, but we all eventually made it. But I'd never flown off a ship at anchor before. I mean, it's been done several times since. But it was quite new to me.
So were you just, again, more flying while you were there?
Not much. We did some flying. I say we'd done it all. We were worked up. The flights I do remember, as I said, at Bankstown, they had all the new aircraft, and I can remember flying in there one morning. I may have flown in as a passenger, but it doesn't matter. I got in there. And there were these rows and rows and rows of brand new American aircraft. There were Hellcats, there were Corsairs, there were Avengers. They were all painted in the British Pacific Fleet colours, which was midnight blue with the white markings on the side. You didn't have any red, the white market, and they were all lined up like guardsmen. There were, I say, hundreds of them, but they were in rows, and it was just extraordinary to see this vast number of brand new aeroplanes. And I mean, they did have a few Barracudas, but we were sort of hidden away in the background somewhere. And I think the idea was we were merely just probably picking up new aircraft and flying them back to Jervis Bay. But this place, Bankstown, as I say, it was virtually on the edge of Sydney. You could see the city from there, and of course the weather was perfect, and it was absolutely gorgeous. They then decided, quite rightly, that if we were going to be operating up in the Pacific, where the huge threat, of course, was the kamikazes, which was the bane of everybody's life up there, that the ship needed extra anti-aircraft guns. I don't know what the weaponry was we had, but I mean, so the ship goes into dry dock in Sydney. It may have been a place called Woolloomooloo, I'm not sure, but there was a dock, Captain Cook Dock, I think it was. And she goes in there, and she's in there for a week or 10 days for having all this new weaponry put on. We were given leave, so we actually went, although the aircraft was still back at Jervis Bay, we went and lived on board the ship while she was in dock, and just enjoyed the delights of Sydney. It was, it was the life of Riley while we were there. So we would just, and I mean, the thing I can remember so well was that in those days, that I think it's probably still the same, that there were very strict drinking laws in Sydney. No drinks were served until 6 o'clock, I think it was, when it was called the swill hour or something. And the bars all opened, everybody rushed in and swigged all the beer they could in the space of about an hour. And then the bar shut. So then, of course, everybody comes back on board. and it was just one long party. And there was a nightclub. We used to go dancing. And it was lovely. The great delicacy in the wardroom, they discovered that, of course, oysters were very cheap. And we used to get these big barrels of oysters brought into the wardroom. And the favourite drink was Guinness, so you had Guinness and oysters. Can't believe what it did to us, but I think oysters were tuppence for half a dozen or something. But it was a life of Riley while we were there in harbour. I was then, I don't know why or how, I can't remember the details, but I was on a train, and I was going presumably from Sydney back to Jervis Bay. I assume that's where I was going. It wasn't just me, I think there were two or three of us. I remember the train was in a station, and I can remember these newsboys rushing along the platform with the newspaper headlines, talking about an atom bomb. I didn't know what they were talking about, an atom bomb. Anyway, this was, the first atom bomb, I think, was dropped on the 8th of August 1945, I think it was the 8th, and this was probably the day after that. It was the 6th, I think. I think the 6th was when the first atom bomb was dropped. This would have been about the 8th, and then of course on the 9th they dropped the second atom bomb on Nagasaki. And of course I was on the train looking at all this, and I suppose we had enough common sense to realise that probably the war might be coming to an end then. Even if it didn't come to an end, what sort of a war was it going to be if they were going to be chucking atom bombs around? We were flogging about with ordinary weapons that we got, and then barracudas and atom bombs didn't quite come in the same category. Anyway, back to Jervis Bay. There still wasn't any final end to the war immediately after that, but I think it was on the 13th of August that we flew back on board. I've got a note in my logbook that we flew back onto the ship, and I took a chap called Stormy Fairweather, who was one of our pilots. He was in my back seat, and we flew back to the ship. And then on the VJ day, but interestingly, VJ Day was originally called VP Day, Victory in the Pacific. So VP Day, as far as we were concerned, was the 15th of August 1945.